come to order, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3471. I'm waiting for Representative Starr to take his place here. I'll mention that we're going to pull from the schedule tonight House Bill 3064. Representative Starr, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, Representative Bruce Starr from House District 3, Western Washington County. With me, I have up here Don McIntyre and Steve Veal. House Bill 3471 is a real simple, easy to understand bill. What it does is it would exclude members of the legislature from membership in PERS. After it would start, the effective date would be the next group of legislators that would be elected. Wouldn't affect the current crop that are here now. It would be effectively effective date after this legislative assembly. A simple bill. I'd be open for any questions, and I know Mr. McIntyre would love to address you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is, I think,
what could I have you?
You know, Don McIntyre from Gresham, Oregon. This is a bill that I think answers the question, why should we have the people's representatives participating in a retirement program that is essentially designed for career government workers. In a free society, we have chosen to have ourselves represented by ordinary citizens who are us, and not part and should not be part of the professional government. And I think anyone who thinks about legislators participating in a government benefits program can see the obvious conflict of interest. In terms of the fiscal consequences, I realize that there's not much of consequence to the taxpayers, except in a way, if you have people participating in a benefits program, which, and this one in particular, is probably if there's ever going to be a looming, and we see the problem looming now, a program that is really going to be a burden to the taxpayers, potentially, that it might be better for the people's representatives to be distanced from that program and to eliminate that conflict of interest. One of the things that I've noticed that were ironic about the legislature's participation in this program is that, for example, the coefficient that is used to determine the rate of return for legislators, is that the same as firemen and policemen? And I guess all three of those are equated as hazardous duty. But I think it has more to do with the fact that when people are in power, they will use that power to improve their own fortunes. Now, I'm not speaking to you directly, but if we can eliminate that appearance of conflict of interest, then I think the citizens themselves will feel better for it. And I think if you pass this bill out, you will cover yourself with glory for your
Mr. Chair.
Thompson,
would you tell me what the rate a legislator gets paid is? What our pay is for this job, for the record?
I think it amounts to about $36,000, doesn't it?
Mr. McIntyre, our pay is $1,400 a month.
Yeah, I know, but you get per diem.
You get per diem for only the time you're in session.
Right.
And
this is for 2 years.
I'll try to get the bill.
We can go through the chair.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I want you to know I voted no on this last time, but there's a public perception out there what you get for this job, mm-hmm. and it's just amazing. I will probably never collect my PERS, and this bill went forward last time in a legislative assembly that was 3125 or 26 and went down. Well, for $1,400 a month, there isn't much to this job. One of the few things is a few people have the opportunity and their future to be able to maybe get something in the term of retirement.
Well, my response to that is that it the way I think many citizens feel is that you are not running, you don't run for office to be elected to a paying job. And in fact, I wish that they would pay you a lot more, either pay you nothing or $100,000 a session, one or the other.
Mr. Chair.
For which? Representative Thompson.
Would you say it's fair that I receive at least minimum wage for this job?
Sure.
I would settle for that.
But why do you need to be in the retirement program? We do have people who, once you're in the legislature, I mean, here's the unseemly part. You come into the legislature, you come in for a short period of time, get yourself vested. That doesn't pay off. But if you use your government connections to get a much higher paying job in the bureaucracy, a la Jane Cease, then you can see that there is a very definite pecuniary interest in that relationship. And so, therefore, I think it would be healthy to avoid that potential conflict.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Starr, how would this bill impact a legislator who has another job as an employee of a government entity that also has PERS?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman,
mm-hmm.
That would be a very good question to ask the PERS folks that are sitting behind us when they come up. My inclination is that it would not, since you have a job outside this process, right. It's also covered by PERS. But if you want a person with actual solid knowledge on the program, I'm sure that Steve Delaney or someone from PERS could answer that question.
If I could have a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Currently, I think everybody knows with term limits, there's three terms in the House, two terms in the Senate, but no more than 12 years in a combination. And any of us that can add knows that it doesn't add up to 12 years. It adds up to 14 years, but 12 years is the max, which means that as of now, there will be no career legislators.
Right.
And the legislative body. And so what is the big cost that we're trying to avoid giving to taxpayers since there will be no career legislators as of now?
Mr. Chair, for the moment, this cost in this program is minimal because of the exact things that you've mentioned. Term limits means that this is not a career in the legislature. I think what Mr. McIntyre mentioned, where we have members that move from the legislative assembly into state bureaucrat or state agency jobs, and not just Jane Cease, but Bob Repine, and I mean the list goes, there's quite a list of those. I think that it is appropriate that we look at this issue as if we're serving for the purpose of serving and not being self-serving.
If I could ask one last follow-up, Mr.
Go
Chair.
Ahead.
Using that same logic, should we also have a prohibition against legislators becoming lobbyists?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman.
I could make more as a lobbyist than I could as a state bureaucrat. That's why I'm asking that question.
I think that's certainly true in some cases, and I think we might have bills in this body to deal with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Representative Sinceri.
Mr. Chair, I would be willing to vote for this bill if Mr. McIntyre would help us craft a piece of legislation that we could get paid combat pay while we're in
there. You know, the thing is, Representative Sinceri, I didn't really mean that. I think that I would like, if I had my way, you'd be paid $100,000 a session, but there'd be a codicil. The session could only be 120 days, and every day over that, we'd take $1,000 a day back. But truly, that would make it possible for a lot of people to afford to come here. It would I think, open the doors for more people to run for office. Because you're right, the pay isn't diddly, and people can't leave their jobs or whatever it is they're doing to come down here. Very few can. So I agree. So I think the pay ought to be higher. It ought to be nothing. I'm just saying you shouldn't be, since you are not truly a government employee, you shouldn't be participating in that government employee program.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, you just touched on one of my questions. I guess the first one would be in terms of if we did this in a vacuum without the other. One of the concerns I have is as I've been in here for 4 years, I really, really strongly believe we need good, thoughtful people in this process. If I can walk away with any experience, I think that. And how attractive are we making it to good, thoughtful Oregonians to come to the process is my question. If we did this without any other, and it's not a minimum wage paying job, I just think it's just more difficult to ask people to take 6 months off out of their lives and come down here and serve. And I just don't know if we're forwarding our goal.
Well, if I may respond, Representative Sunseri was saying, you know, if I would support combat pay, I tell you what, I would support increasing your pay. And if that was even a quid pro quo, if this legislature decides that legislators should not participate in PERS, I'd absolutely go to bat to see your compensation increase. That's a separate issue, but I think it's a legitimate issue.
What's relating?
Representative Decker to follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my other question, I was just trying to think, Representative Starr, offhand, how many legislators, I'm trying to think, I know a ton that are in the Capital Club book. I can think of a ton or a bunch, but I can't think, I think of Jane and I think of Bob. I was trying to think of in the last 10 to 15 years how many there are out there that have transitioned from state government, and I don't know, I'm sure since it was one of the key points of this legislation that you guys might have passed it out of how many that number is in the last two decades. But
no, actually, I'm Mr. Chair, Representative Deckard. I don't have a composite list of every legislator that's been in the bureaucracy or ever has. I can think of one other, Dave McTeague. Getting stuff in my mind.
Mike Thorne.
Well, that's Port of Portland. I mean,
that's big pay.
Mike Burton.
It's still in PERS.
Burton.
Mike Burton.
Well, he's elected to the. I mean, we're reaching here. I mean, he's elected by the people of Portland to serve at the Metro.
Yeah, Rod Monroe.
Okay, could we go ahead and move along? Representative Thompson.
I would like a little bit of leniency because this issue is something that, to me, and I think we're after the same thing. We want the best legislators we can to do the best job. And since I've been on this side, of the issue, one of the areas that's bothered me is not my pay, but the lack of staff that I've given in a rural district. Mm-hmm. Because when I leave this body and I go back out there, mm-hmm. I have to do virtually everything because all I have is a half-time staff, and it takes away from my other job I need in order to pay so I can do this job properly. That is one area, myself personally, I don't care, but if I could have one thing, and it isn't PERS, it would be an adequate staff in the interim so I could do the job better for my citizens.
Mr. Chair, if I could make one more comment.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you. I just wanted to share with the panel, when I made the decision initially to run for public office, I talked for a very long time with my husband because I knew that we were going to lose somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 every time I came to this body to serve. And if you think that anybody does this job for the money or for the benefits or for the appreciation or anything else that we get, I think that somebody's been sadly misinformed. And to follow up on what Representative Thompson said, when I go back to my other local government job, I then have two full-time jobs. I have to still be responsive to my constituents as well as be responsive to the local government that I work for. And that $1,400 a month that I get, I mean, it's, trust me when I tell you, it nowhere near covers what it is the expectations are of me to do. And so I think that this is, I think we're picking out one piece because, if you may let me finish, please. I think we're picking out one piece because PERS has been in the news so much of late. And what we're not doing is looking at how we can get good quality people to be willing to make the financial and personal sacrifices that we must make in order to serve in this body. And so to just deal with this one piece and not look at the whole picture of how do we make this a place that people want to come. I know we have a heck of a time trying to find somebody that wants to do this.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Beal. I'm from Gresham, Oregon. I came down here on a matter of principle. I worked on term limits when it was up before the voters. I felt very strongly about it, and I was frankly surprised when it passed down here because I didn't think most of the people down here would think too much, too highly of term limits. But there's a principle involved. And the principle, as far as I can see, with term limits, federal and state, is to push the legislators who make the laws away from the pot, from the honey pot, money pot. And I just think it's the question of salary and compensation is one issue. The principle behind putting legislators in charge of a retirement program that they benefit from is another error in judgment.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Thompson.
And I appreciate what you tried to do in term limits, and I have some problems with that, too. I think we lose some integrity. There's a point where I think it's reasonable at where we might have got too short. I'd like to see the terms be able to serve in either house, and I appreciate the fact that you're here. One of the things I do serve on is the Pacific Legislative Task Force, and I have the good fortune to be able to visit with legislators around the Pacific. And Oregon and Idaho are the two farthest down on the scale of benefits they receive. Idaho has a very short session and a very small budget. If you reflect this in terms of budget, Oregon is way below any other states. Not saying that's right or wrong, but at some point you say, you know, how far down the scale do you want to be? And PERS is a very small benefit. I'm going to tell you publicly, I've been here for 6 years. My total PERS benefit package, I think, is $4,700 for 6 years in this body. That's my benefit package. That's not what I receive. I only get a percentage of that. That's how small it is.
Well, my point is, it's a matter of principle. I can appreciate the compensation package that you receive or how short it is. But what I'm trying to point out here is that PERS flies in the face of the voters who gave us a mandate to limit your terms. Now, term limits and this debate we're into right now this evening conflict with one another because if term limits is carried out, nobody has to worry about PERS except Jane Cease. So we're talking about principle.
Any further? All right, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to have maybe a representative or two from PERS come up just for a moment. I've got a question I would like to.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, sir. Members of the committee, Fred McDonald, Director of PERS, and with me is Steve Delaney, our legislative liaison. And we are here to answer any questions that you or other members might have. We did supply some written testimony to Representative Starr, and I think that you have that in front of you, and we'd be happy to cover that if you would like us to.
I just have one simple question, really, that I wanted to ask, and that is the history of legislators being classified along with police and fire personnel here. What is the history of that?
Mr. Chairman, as far as I know, the history of that has to do with, much of it has to do with discussion that you've already had in the past few minutes, and that basically is around the compensation package of legislators, that it has been historically very low, and that this was one method in which to add to that compensation package, because you don't get some of the other features that police and firefighters do get. For example, the age. You don't get to retire at an earlier age like police and firefighters. The only thing that you do get is the additional factor of 2% as opposed to 1.67, which everybody else gets.
Right.
Plus, the other thing, Mr. Chairman, that has been brought up, that if a legislator did transfer to another or go to another position, a government position, there are certain rights that the legislator takes with himself or herself.
Mm-hmm. And just follow up to that, if a legislator were to move over into a state position, that same classification moves with the with the legislator who moves on?
Well, yeah, part of it does, part of it doesn't. The way it is presently constructed is that the time that you serve as a legislator is calculated in one manner, and the time that you would serve as a government employee would be calculated in another manner, but there is still some blending of the two. You get some of the advantages on your final salary at a higher rate of the government employee, presumably higher rate than what you're receiving as a legislator, but you would be benefiting from the years you served as a legislator using that higher salary as opposed to the $1,400 a month, if I make myself clear there.
Fine.
So you do get the benefits of both if you do move.
Right. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could you answer my question? I work for a local government. I take a leave of absence for 6 months to come down here and serve every other year. I'm crazy like that. And then I go back to my local government. If this bill were to pass, what would that mean for me?
Representative Wilson, or Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, that if you take a leave of absence for that six-month period, then you do not accrue service time for that six-month period. You still maintain your membership in the system so that when you come back, you would reenter as a full-time employee. However, now you accrue service time as a legislator, mm-hmm. Albeit at a smaller salary, but if this bill were to pass, you would not accrue service time during that six-month period of any from either position.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair, and so somewhere in the future, I hope one day I'm old enough to retire. I hope I am. and is there a disadvantage for me as a local government employee in becoming a legislator by having those 6 months gap in my benefits package as someone who one day hopes to retire?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, indeed there is.
And would
indeed
you
there is, because service time is used in the calculation of one's benefit at retirement. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, you would not have contributions coming in on your behalf into the system for that period of time. So you lose on two counts.
So it costs me more money to serve than it currently does.
It would indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate that. I see no one left to testify here on this, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3471. And now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3623. And Representative Sunseri, please.
Something about the right side is this.
hey, we're right.
Hey, we got the side closest to the door.
I think I'll use it.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The record, Ryan Sunseri, State Representative, District 22. This is a bill that is not important to some people in the state of Oregon, and I understand that. But it is a bill that is immensely important to many people in the state of Oregon. I don't intend to drag this out or to make it some kind of an emotional pitch here at all, but I want you to know why it's important to some people in the state of Oregon, because they are deeply and emotionally and probably forever connected to this issue. While I was in Vietnam, I buried my roommate, and I had to write letters home to some other very close friends, to their wives and to their parents as a commander. And there were other helicopter pilots that I worked with that when we sent in the troops where the helicopter had gone down, the ones that we didn't find hanging from the rotor blades were missing and are still missing. There are 2,500 POWs missing in action, servicemen in Southeast Asia today, and I suspect that most of them are not living but they are still missing in action. 60 of those are from the state of Oregon. And I think back to other wars, and I think back to those men and women who were part of the Bataan Death March that were languished in POW camps, and it's something that we as Americans must never forget. I think of the people who struggled in Korea, and when the United Nations sold out the American troops, and there were many Americans who were captured and became prisoners of war as a result of that action on the part of the United Nations. Those men, and many of them, have still never returned. And to think that today we still have some POWs from our latest skirmish, it's something that will probably be with us as long as Americans are willing to stand up and fight for liberty. And I believe that this bill is very appropriate, that we ask public entities to fly that POW-MIA flag throughout our state. Flag costs less than $50, and there are many groups that will be willing to donate them. We have suggested a Dash 1 amendment, because when this bill was drafted, they left out the 4th of July, and so the Dash 1 amendments adds the 4th of July. So there are 6 days where we would like to see the POW-MIA flag flown. And again, it's not my intention to make this some emotional pitch here. I don't talk about that part of my military experience at all, but you need to know that there are reasons that there are many people who are deeply connected to this issue. And whether those men and women are ever recovered is the issue that they stood for, and we need to remember and pass that knowledge on to our generations after us.
Thank you. Questions?
It says in here, public bodies. Just, I'm not sure. Does that include schools? What all are we talking about when you say public bodies?
Line 14.
There must be a definition.
City halls, and there is a definition. And
line 14.
Line 14.
Yeah, line 14 of the bill.
State, county, and city.
Well, I guess then we're talking about schools too.
Yes.
And okay, that's virtually everybody then.
No, it doesn't include schools.
It does not include schools?
Yep.
Okay, let's see.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So then it's, and then
right.
What is going to be the cost of the state for this?
Actually, I don't think it's less than $25 per flag, correct?
Mr. Chair, members, there's a minimal fiscal impact on this bill, which is less than $50,000. So it's probably way less than
$50,000. Yeah, that's what I'm...
Mm-hmm.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Sanceri. I have a practical question, and I'm serious about this. The 6 days listed, 4 of those 6 days are holidays. Who's going to come in and put up the flag? 6 of those, you know what I'm saying? 4 of those days are days where those public buildings are closed.
Whoever it is that comes in and puts up the American flag on those days, holidays, and make sure that from the city cap or from city halls and those. I know the city of Gresham's got someone that comes in and puts their flag up on the 4th of July and those days that are holidays.
I don't think we have anyone that does.
Further questions?
All right. Thank you very much. Next up will be John Mangus, Department of Veterans Affairs, please.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Mangus. I'm the Director of Veterans Affairs in the state of Oregon, and I'm here today to speak in favor of and urge your support for House Bill 3623. I think 3623 is a very simple bill, but it makes a powerful statement. In legislation, all that's required is that a public body display the POW-MIA flag on certain specified days. I don't know the military history of anyone on this committee except for Representative Sanceri and Representative Harper. And so perhaps this legislation isn't necessarily important to people who have not served, or to it is important to the families of those men and women who are still in POW or MIA status. And families need to know that America does remember and does care. Since 1984, the POW-MIA flag has flown at the Veterans Building down on the mall here as a reminder for all to see it, and it flies every day. It used to fly here at the Capitol, but it doesn't anymore. And I know a lady in Portland by the name of Ann Backinson, whose father was shot down in 1953. And she grew up thinking that her father, Lieutenant Robert Nyman, was killed in action in service to his country. But she was shocked one day in 1992 while having breakfast and reading the Oregonian when she saw her father's name. He was mentioned in the article that a Russian colonel had interrogated him at some time transitioning from North Korea into the Soviet Union. And it's almost impossible today to get information about his Korea old business or his Vietnam old business and his Serbia, where we do have three POWs at the present time. And I think in speaking on behalf of Reagan veterans, I urge you to pass this legislation and on behalf to answer any questions regarding veterans or POWs might have.
Thank you. Questions? All right, thank you very much. Next up will be Ron Harlan, VFW, Coalition Veterans Issues, and Purple Heart recipient. Welcome.
For the record, my name is Ron Harlan. I'm legislative officer for the Veterans of Foreign Wars Military Order of the Purple Heart in the state of Oregon. We did not sponsor this bill, but we will sign on to it. We believe it's a good bill. From my particular era, there's over 70,000 still missing. They'll never be found at this stage, but it's a way to remember them, and I don't want to take up a lot of your valuable time. Just wanted you to know we do back this bill, and we sincerely hope you will pass it.
Thank you, sir, and appreciate your service. Thank you. All right. Very good. we have dash one amendments that you... Pardon me? Yes. We have dash one amendments, so if you'll take a look at that, we'll close a public hearing on House Bill 3623 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
House
Mr.
Bill
Chair.
3623. Representative Thompson.
I'd like to move the dash one amendments into 3623.
Representative Thompson moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3623. Any discussion? Any objections? So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
I'd like to move House Bill 3623 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves House Bill 3623 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Representative Thompson.
I think it's a good bill. I you know, it's funny, until Representative Sinceri had happened to mention to me just before we come in here, it's funny how you forget an issue that was that burning in your life, and this is a good bill.
Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Beck?
I, too, think this is a good bill. It's, you know, I've heard me talk about generational differences and the X generation, which I consider myself a part. One of the things that the X generation has not had to experience is a war. Not had to see people my age and younger go off and fight a war. And I often think that whatever problems that my generation has, sometimes it's due to the fact that they haven't had to tough it. They haven't had to fight a foreign aggressor. And I think that this bill will serve to remind people, generations who fortunately have not had to go abroad and risk their lives, that other generations did. And I think of the autumn campfire I spend every year with my father's high school friends who all fought in Europe. And I hear those stories then once a year. But I think this is a good thing to be doing, and as a member of the X generation, I'm proud to be supporting it.
Thank you, Representative Beck. Further discussion? All right, we have a motion, and any objection to its adoption? All right, seeing none, House Bill 3623 is passed. And Representative Sinceri?
I suggest, Mr. Chair, that Representative Harper and I co-carry the bill.
That would be fine. Thank you. All right, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3623.
Here you go, Mr. Chair.
Just to mention, in case any of you are here for House Bill 3064, I mentioned at the outset that we were pulling that from the agenda for tonight. Okay, well, we will go ahead and jump ahead in our schedule. We'll come back to another one of our issues later. Let's go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 3502. And I'd like Joe Gilliam and Tom Butler to come forward. Representative Butler, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Butler, House District 60, in Ontario.
All right, thank you for your appearance. I wanted you to, perhaps you and Mr. Gilliam could bring us up to speed here. I noticed that on 3502 now you have a dash one amendment. Would either of you or... Pardon me? Okay. We'll hold up for a moment as those are passed out. In fact, let's take a moment as a committee to peruse those.
I think it's about the third page in the handout that you received last year.
Sure, it's top of the, I separated those handouts from your handout, so it's the top of the handout with the colored paper.
Chair, well, Faye is passing that out. There's also at your place some information from Faith that they delivered to my office yesterday, some background information that Representative Atkinson had requested.
I'll continue to take a moment here for the committee to take a look at the dash ones. Gentlemen, if you would explain the intent of the amendment and the bill once again to us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. If I could refer to 3503 as well, but 3502 specifically, the intent of 3502. Was that the dividend distributions policy should be accounted for on an annual basis, and that policy be published and it be complied with, and this was the nature of 3502 and 3503. We talked about the potential of an audit, but let's if we could limit it because of the discussion on. With the dash one amendments on 3502, what the request is that the State Accident Industrial Fund be prohibited from using those that rather substantial amount of past dividend accumulations or past accumulations to advertise or market or promote or suggest the effect of the dividend declaration on the future premiums as it's going about its selling activities. And that, again, that we would ask for an independent audit to the DCPS to verify the accuracy of the distributions and compliance with the provisions of this section. The department would then reimburse the reasonable cost for the independent audit to the State Action and by the State Action Industrial Fund. Recognizing also that the State Action Industrial Fund is subject to audit at this point. This basically would confirm an additional item, and that is that, number one, that the dividend policy is being adhered to, and that very specifically the packets include that you have been handed out, include some points, and I'll go ahead and let Mr. Gilliam refer to those points, if you would.
Thank you. And I don't want to belabor the issue too much in that we have a hearing, and so I would primarily like to discuss a couple of things. First of all, how these two measures relate to one another, and then ultimately an explanation of the purpose of the dash ones.
Okay. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Joe Gilliam, representing the National Federation of Independent Business. The two bills relate to each other, and 3503 requires the requires Safe Corporation to, in their yearly, they already make a report yearly to the legislature and the governor, and it makes it specific in that report that they already file that they will file their distribution, dividend distribution policy. The reason that's significant is that the statute in 3502 says that the dividend distribution policy will not be unfairly discriminatory. And that's important, that that's a very important cog to the dividend process, and that all businesses are treated in a like manner, in a like group, that small is not being discriminated for big because those are the most more attractive accounts. In 3502, it says after you've made a report, which is in 3503, there will be an audit to make sure you're complying with the requirement of being not being unfairly discriminatory. So that's how the two are linked. They were written separately. I don't know that it was there was any requirement other than LC chose to write the bills that way. I don't think there's any magic to it. Unfortunately, they're in two bills. I know it's awkward, and I apologize.
Would you explain the dash ones?
The dash one amendments were the issue we brought to you during the hearing regarding how SAFE advertises the dividends. The dividends are an extreme advantage in the marketplace, and they know that, admit to that, and that's not really under an argument between the two. In 1998, their investment income, which is tax-free, actually exceeded their premiums they took in their primary business of covering employers for workers' compensation. That's a very important issue, and how your stewardship over that fund and how you use it is critical to how a three-way system operates, a three-way being self-insured, private carriers, and a state fund. And if you cross over the line with that kind of tax-free power, you can do good things, you can do bad things. And some of their advertising, which I brought you an example last time, they use those dividends as a pricing gimmick to really scare off the private carriers and competing in the market. Now, in the hearing, Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman had asked for more examples that were more specific and to businesses that had names on the comparison, so she had a more comfortable feeling with verifying them. I've done that. Those are the yellow copies, if you avail yourself to those. The Dash 1 amendments just says that they can't use, under current statute, they can't promise dividends unless they're declared. And this just takes one step further, since they've been using those dividends to advertise, saying you can't use those to project a premium price in the future. Important thing is does not prohibit or limit in any way Safe Corporation's ability to give dividends or the amount they want to give. They just can't use it in their pricing and advertising.
All right. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Davey, could we have you come on?
Mr. Chair, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. Did you have a specific question to begin with, or would you like me to just speak to these amendments?
I wanted to make you available to this group for just a moment. We don't exactly want to reinvent the wheel here tonight, but I guess one question that I might ask, now that you've had an opportunity to, and I trust you have, looked at the dash ones.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And an opportunity to get a grip on what this particular bill asks for and its companion bill would ask for. Do you see this as imposing any grievous injury on SAFE?
Mr. Chair, I guess to answer that, we'd have to look at whether there is really a problem here that needs to be addressed. And the material that I passed around deals with one of the concerns about the fact that SAFE allegedly is such a presence in the marketplace that nobody else can compete. And I think you heard that NFIB couldn't partner with Hartford because they can't compete with SAFE. Material that you've received there, I won't go through it in detail, but it clearly shows that Hartford is the fastest growing small insurance company, private insurance company in the state. They take a significant amount of business away from SAFE Corporation. They're growing significantly without involvement with NFIB. There doesn't seem to be a problem in terms of SAFE dominating the market. There certainly isn't a problem in terms of whether SAFE is violating the statutes or the rules about the payment of dividends. So I would suggest that to create a statute that is unique to SAFE and say that SAFE Corporation will be limited in how it can reference past dividends and future expectations of what employers might pay does create an undue burden on SAFE and an unnecessary burden because no problem has been shown to exist.
Thank you. Any questions? If you'd like to go ahead and speak to a couple of other issues that may have struck you.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I think the proposal that SAFE not speak about dividends when it comes to discussing potential costs with our existing customers or potential customers not only harms SAFE's ability to market its product, but it also harms the ability of the customer to get a full information about what their potential costs will be. You can imagine that one of our account representatives might go to a customer and be asked, well, you've paid dividends in the past, haven't you? What might your what might my net cost be in the future? And perhaps they'd say, well, XYZ Mutual Company was just in here last week and they said they pay a dividend, and if they continue to pay at that rate, our net cost would be such and so. By the terms of this bill, SAFE would be prohibited from talking about whether we paid past dividends and how they might influence future net costs to those policyholders. Incidentally, this would also be very much to the advantage of our principal competitor because they don't pay dividends to policyholders in this state. They pay dividends to stockholders, and the fact that SAFE couldn't talk about its dividends would obviously play into the hands of Liberty Northwest. As far as the independent audit report requirement goes, I think I documented in the last hearing that there is no problem with SAFE's dividend payments in the past. What this bill would do would essentially ask DCBS to pre-approve any dividend that we would pay. We'd have to go to them, give them all the paperwork, and say, will you agree that this meets with the terms of the statute? They would have to go out and hire an independent auditor. Apparently, DCBS couldn't be trusted to do that with their own expertise either. They would have to get an independent audit report that would delay the payment of dividend, that would add to the cost. So, as it says in the bill, would have to bear that cost. So we don't see the need for this bill. The only thing that seems to be driving it is the self-interest of the parties that are proposing it. It's going to add to the cost of insurance. It's going to make SAFE less competitive, and it will simply advantage private insurance companies.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Bowman.
I thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question for me is this really comes down to an issue of we currently have an insurance program where private business owners are getting a competitive rate for insurance, for workers' comp. We've obviously done a very good job of reducing that cost. We've got low premiums. The employers are happy. And we're being asked now to make a shift so that a private insurance agency can come in and kind of pick the cream of the crop off of the businesses that are in the area. That's really what we're being asked to do here, in my opinion. It seems like if this, in fact, is working for the people who have chosen SAFE as their insurance carrier, and from everything I've read and received, everybody's happy that has SAFE as a carrier. The people that aren't happy are the number two people who want a greater percentage of the insurance market, which will increase costs for everybody. So I'm trying to understand what it is we're trying to fix, because it clearly looks to me like if we pass both of these pieces of legislation, it will be only to impact an insurance company that wants a bigger share of the profit in this market. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, I think you're right. You don't see employers here in this room saying that there is a problem for them, that they want to have more choices of insurance companies. As you've already heard, there are many insurance companies that actively market in this state. So we're not hearing a clamor from employers from this. You're not hearing a clamor from DCBS saying we need more tools to regulate safe. They've given us glowing reports. I would just say that if you feel that you want to know more about safe dividends, then I would suggest that you vote for House Bill 3503, which is the companion bill that calls for the annual report to the Legislative Assembly on safe dividend practices. But voting for House Bill 3502, if I get my numbers straight, is really just creating a disadvantage for safe in the marketplace when we believe we're doing exactly what the legislature intended.
Thank you. Representative Atkinson.
Thank you for providing this document. I haven't ordered it in the manner which I'm accustomed to. I usually spend some time. I had it today. Yeah, really. First question, has there ever been a year when you have not given a dividend?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, I think since 1990, we have paid a dividend every year. Before 1990, as you're aware, the workers' compensation market was quite a bit different, and I believe for a number of years we either paid no dividend or a small amount. Brian Steffel could perhaps comment on that.
For the record, my name is Brian Steffel with Safe Corporation, and Chris is correct. There were several years in the 1980s we did not pay a dividend because we were in financial trouble.
Forecast having a dividend next year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, I believe that our financial condition will be very good next year, and later this year, it's more likely than not that we'll be able to pay a dividend, but there are a lot of contingencies it's possible to say right now.
Would the suggestion of a dividend be an unfair advantage in your mind of competing for new business?
I don't believe it's an unfair advantage at all. Other companies use dividends as well. It's been in the marketplace for years and years. No carrier is allowed to promise a dividend. They're only allowed to say that if a dividend is declared, it may be declared in a certain way, but it's all contingent on the board of directors and our financial situation, as is with every other company.
Well, go ahead. Under your current rules, and since this is a quasi-public private enterprise, as I understand it, and I think that given the nature of this issue and perhaps my interest in politics, this might not be the last time that we discuss the intricacies of this fabulously subject, which is in my 10th hour in committee hearings today. I'm so excited to
talk. You got in so late.
That
was a good one.
No, that's hearing. He would slow me down. I had a great question. Given the nature of this type of institution that's created, say, would it not be a good thing to report your dividends after the fact, how much you've given out to the Legislative Assembly? I guess this speaks to the other bills, but while the synapses are firing, I might as well ask a question now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, certainly we don't have any problem with that. That information is readily available today. People haven't asked for it, but it is available, and we would be more than willing to do that.
One more question.
Go ahead.
And let me just ask this before we get there. So are you in favor of the next bill? Are you opposed to the next bill? Are you have a lack of better phrase, oh, whatever, about the next bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, oh, whatever. I think, as I testified at the previous hearing, it doesn't seem necessary that there has to be a bill for us to provide dividend information, but we're more than happy to do that.
Thank you. I'd like to ask, you made a statement that the passage of 3502 with the dash one would cause the cost of insurance to go up. develop that for us, if you will.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Well, the direct cost of that, of course, would be the independent audit report that SAFE would have to be responsible for. Not a big amount in the big scheme of things, but nonetheless, it's an additional cost that has to be passed on to our policyholders. And as the amount that we pay in dividends is essentially what's left after we've covered all of our costs and our liabilities, then that is a cost that would ultimately end up being deducted from the amount that we would pay out as dividends. I guess the other issue is that if we were inhibited in our ability to talk about the fact that we even pay dividends, this would play into the hands of our competition, who would be able to perhaps do better in the marketplace. If they do, then maybe we would not be able to get the kind of business that we have today, and perhaps our prices would go up because the selection of business that we receive would be worse.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Yes, this is a good idea that's about to come.
Well, I've got it figured out since we've had this other bill on PERS that we could conceptually amend this, because I think this sounds like a better deal than that PERS.
We could run a minority report.
Thank you very much for that. Any further questions for these gentlemen? All right, thank you.
That's pretty clever.
All right, I think what I'd like to do is bring Representative Butler and Mr. Gilliam back for just a moment before we decide what to do here.
Dividends can stick for legislation. Minority report.
Mr. Chair will take that as a friendly amendment.
Well, welcome back. You know, I want to ask you a question here about the Dash 1 amendments. Under the Dash 1 safe would be from how Mr. Davey interprets it, would be prohibited from saying anything about dividends at all in their pitches. Is that the intent, essentially, of the Dash 1s, that they would not say anything about those?
Mr. Chair, for record again, Joe Gilliam with NFIB, actually it would not prohibit them talking about their dividends or their dividend history. It does prohibit them from suggesting a price based on dividends. So if you would, if you just looked at the first copy of the yellow examples, yellow pages, they could talk about the dividend history. They could talk about that they give dividends. They could even talk about the amount of dividends they've given. But they could not overlay it in a pricing structure that shows $235,000 worth of insurance for $64,000 next to their private carrier who doesn't have the same advantages who at $123,000. They wouldn't be able to do that bottom block and subtotal. If someone asked them or an agent, do you give dividends or did you give one last year? How much was the dividend? They would be free and within their rights to answer those questions.
Go ahead.
These are faxes that go out to companies. Companies are looking at them very quickly, and it's really unfair pricing to people who don't have that same type of tax-free advantage. And we're just saying we're not going to limit that or prohibit them from giving their dividends. We just don't think it's fair to price it the way they're doing here.
Let me ask you, do typical insurance companies run a line like potential net cost based on past dividend history?
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen any as I've researched through the marketing material. Some may, but there's no other ones that can offer this big an advantage in the marketplace. The problem you have with a three-way system, I mean, the three-way systems have been a pretty good thing, and we're not knocking it. But it's a delicate balance because you have three different animals in the same cage. And they all have their strengths and weaknesses, but the biggest strengths are on the safe side. They were set up that way. I mean, Mr. Davies is absolutely correct. They're operating exactly as they were intended to operate. They haven't, you know, gone off the track and created anything new. It's just that there is an inherent advantage, and we're saying that their past practices have kept one of the legs of the three-party system, one leg of the stool from becoming stronger and being equal in the participation.
All right, thank you. Any further questions?
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the Dash 1 amendments on line 6, where it says that DCBS shall provide an independent audit report, do you anticipate that that would be outside of DCBS or that DCBS would be the independent auditor? Mr. Davies suggested that they would have to, that his interpretation of this language would require the DCBS to go outside of its organization, have an independent audit, which would eventually cost more money than if it was in-house. Can you address how you meant for that to be interpreted?
Tom Butler from Ontario, representative from House District 60. The DCBS, through the Secretary of State, presently conducts audit on a number of agencies, and what this would do is that with regard to the regular audit, and those are conducted by CPAs that are employed by the Secretary of State's office, as by and large. And what this would do is that independent Secretary of State CPA would go ahead and verify the accuracy, the distribution, and the compliance with the stated policy of what their policy is to give out the distributions of the dividends.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm a little bit more confused now. Because the language talks about DCBS doing the audit, and you're saying the Secretary of State would do the audit. I
believe the DCBS contracts through the Secretary of State. Secretary of State has a number of CPAs on staff.
I see.
To provide that throughout the various state agencies, to provide that service throughout the state, to each of the various state organizations. That's my understanding, Representative Starr.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, and I guess either of you can answer this, how will business owners benefit by making these changes and SAFE? Is it your contention that somehow businesses who currently are insured by SAFE will end up paying less in premium costs if they go with someone else other than SAFE?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, thank you very much. Let me take you back for just a little bit. On 4/15, on April 15th, when we met, they told us that we had testimony before the committee that what you see on the yellow sheets was absolutely not happening. And they questioned whether or not it ever happened, even anecdotally. That the one question that they had was that was this in fact something that ever did happen. Number one, it is happening and it continues to happen. Number two, you've got to take into consideration that all of the money that we're talking about is a huge tax-free largess of money that has never been taxed and never will be taxed as long as it is locked up the way that it is. And it continues to earn profits tax-free. And so will it save money? Yes, by distributing tax-free money out. As a matter of fact, the testimony is given today that they made more money in investing the money, the tax-free money that's been set aside, than they even collected in premiums. I guess the answer to your question is yes. By distributing tax-free money to people throughout the state, this could break every insurance company. It could bring the price down to the point where it could basically keep the price so low that no one can compete with the state's insurance cartel.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Go ahead.
Representative, I appreciate what you said, and I know you believe this strongly in the core of your being. What I'm trying to understand is who will benefit by this change. Currently, we have many employers who have their workers covered by SAFE. Those employers are not complaining because they have low premiums. They're getting a rebate back. Cost has been kept low. Profits are high. They're investing the money well. They will be able to cover any major catastrophe that takes place. The only thing I hear about why that's bad is that this poor insurance company that's growing at a 300% annual rate can't compete in this market. I don't have a problem with that. If employees are covered, employers are happy, why should I pass a piece of legislation to let this poor company come in and be able to write policy? That's what I'm trying to see. I mean, we're talking about balancing public policy. And if, in fact, we've got a significant number of employers who I mean, no, we've had no employer come in here and say, SAFE has given me the runaround. They've screwed me over. By golly, I want to be able to get insurance from somebody else, but they won't. But I can't because SAFE is somehow preventing me from doing that. I think if they want to pay more, they can.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman. The testimony that you have and the information that's been provided from testimony previously given by SAFE is that 70% of the market share is already controlled by SAFE. In other words, they're already at over two-thirds and coming to three-quarters of the entire market share of the small business market. And so they already control that portion of it. And what we're saying is, no, there's not anyone complaining with regard to the fact that their insurance costs are held low, and they're held low. But you got to recognize that that's a contrived low amount, and because it is contrived, it keeps free enterprise and tax-paying businesses out of the state. And if we want to continue to be able to spend general fund revenues within the state, we're going to have to generate some taxable income, and that taxable income is going to have to be taxed within the state. And the way we do that is we encourage private enterprise to come to the state. We don't discourage them and say, you know, come to Oregon, but don't stay. We just say, don't come to Oregon, because 70% is already controlled, and in large part, it's controlled by virtue of the fact that this huge largess of tax-free money has been accumulated and is earning a vast return greater than the premiums themselves. And what's happening is that this then is being used to keep private insurance from coming into the state and paying a tax on the premiums that they earn, the net profits that they earn.
I have one last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
In the state of Oregon, I believe the number is 85 or 87% of businesses in the state of Oregon are considered small businesses, so they have 100 or less employees. I believe that the figure is 78% of those have 10 employees or less. And so I don't know that there's going to be a big rush to employ those small employers by a major insurance company anywhere. I mean, I understand that the reason we have SAFE is because it was so difficult for those small employers to be able to get appropriate workers' compensation coverage for their employees. And so I guess I'm just having a hard time understanding where the mad rush will be coming from for these very small employers who need this coverage.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond to that from personal experience, and that is that when SAFE got into trouble and couldn't earn the rather substantial amount that it was then earning and couldn't pay the rather high overhead which they'd been able to accumulate, then what happened was that they took all of the small policies that they had at that particular time, the majority of them, and just cut them off and said, you're no longer insured. You go find insurance somewhere else. You're in the high-risk pool, whether or not you've had accidents. And that's the problem with this kind of an arrangement. A private company normally would never do something like that. A company which is quasi-municipal has every ability to do that because they're not accountable. They're not accountable to shareholders. They're not accountable to taxpayers. They're not accountable to any of us.
Thank you. Mr. Gilliam, any final comment before we move on?
No.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. We'll stand down the committee for just a minute. Reminder, we're in a work session on House Bill 3502, and if anyone has a motion, we entertain it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
Move the dash ones in the House Bill 3502.
Representative Atkinson moves the dash one amendments in the House Bill 3502. Is there any discussion? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Yeah.
Deck?
Nope.
Bowman?
Nope.
Deckard?
No.
Harper?
Yes.
Starr?
Yep.
Sunseri?
Yes.
Thompson?
No.
Wilson?
Aye. And motion carries. And entertain another motion.
Chair, I move House Bill 3502 as amended to the floor. Do pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves House Bill 3502 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk?
Atkinson?
Yes.
Beck?
No, I serve notice of possible minority report.
Bowman?
No, I also serve notice of a possible minority report.
Decker?
No, and I don't serve a narrow, none of them. I don't know what it would be.
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
No.
Wilson?
Aye. Motion carries, and Representative Butler, if you would carry that. Thank you. All right, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3502, and we will open a work session on House Bill 3503. And do we have a motion on House Bill 3503? Representative Atkinson has moved House Bill 3503 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'd just make one quick general comment that I just get a ton of stuff in the interim, much of which, and I don't know if I'm at fault here, but some of which I don't read. I'm happy to vote yes, but this will just be another item, and I know we get a ton, but we could get another piece.
Well, serious? He doesn't read all that stuff? He's a state representative.
I get it on tape.
Any further discussion?
You'll hear that statement again.
Minority report.
You'll see that statement.
Mark that place on the tape, please.
All right, we have a motion, and no further discussion. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Yes. Deck?
No.
Bowman?
No.
Deckard?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. Right, carries. Representative Butler, that's yours. Okay?
One more.
All right, we'll close the work session on the House Bill 3503.
Where are you going?
No, we got to create the Marion County State Land.
We got to fix where? Marion County Land.
Marion County State Land Legislative Commission.
No, we got that 2733.
We're not here. That's a
large. These folks have left the government and created a whole lot of commissions.
Okay, we got one more to go.
I know.
Okay, we'll open the work session on House Bill 2743.
Okay.
And, Kara, if you would explain that to us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll do my best. There are dash two amendments that replace the original bill. They modify the Capital Planning Commission statute to add disposition of property in jurisdiction of the commission as part of their mission and various other sundry places. Carl Myers, who's the chair of the Capital Planning Commission, is here to answer questions if you have them. There's also a fiscal impact on the dash twos. It's basically indeterminate. The measure has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but that was based on the original bill that created an entirely new commission.
So we still have to go to Ways and Means?
You can choose not to send. You can choose to recommend that the Ways and Means referral be rescinded.
Good. Are we in work session?
Yes.
Would you accept the motion, Mr. Chair?
we can do that.
Mr. Chair, I sure would like to know the major difference in the Dash 2 amendments. I mean, I know what we were going to do. I'm not quite sure what this current commission is and how long it exists and who's on it and all that good stuff, and I really would rather not vote until I know that.
Let's have Mr. Myers come forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Myers is very glad he stuck around.
He goes to committee.
All right. Mr. Myers, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Carl Myers, I am the chair of the Capital Planning Commission. Representative Mannix could not be here tonight because of another engagement. He was so kind to speak in, on behalf of the Capital Planning Commission budget today in Ways and Means. I thought the least I could do was cover his bill this afternoon, this evening. Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, the Capital Planning Commission has been around since 1948 in its current form. It was formed in a previous incarnation in 1943, so it's been around in one form or another since 1943. We serve as a planning body for state lands in Marion and Polk County. Our role most recently has been to serve as an interface between state government and local government, the city of Salem and Marion County, as well as the neighborhoods. When a state agency decides to put up a building, change a building, do something with their property, it has an impact on the surrounding neighborhoods. It has an impact on the city of Salem, their transportation plan, their infrastructure, so on and so forth. Buildings also have an aesthetic to them, and all of those, we oversee all state building projects within Marion and Polk County to make sure that the city of Salem has been consulted, that it fits within their plan, their land use planning, and we have plans for the Capitol Mall, the area out on Airport where the military department is, the state hospital, and the corrections division between State and Center Street, and other state-owned properties such as Fairview and so on and so forth. And so agencies bring their capital plans to us, we review them, and approve them if they fit within not only our plans, but again, work well with the surrounding communities. We also are involved in the planning process to make sure we stay ahead of that and that agencies get some guidance. Again, our role is to make sure that the state government doesn't walk over local government and vice versa. The Dash 2 amendments, in the previous hearing on this bill, Representative Mannix talked about the fact that maybe instead of forming a whole new commission, that we, with the simple wording, expand the or make sure that the jurisdiction of the Capital Planning Commission was clear, so that we would take, we would be part of any disposition of state-owned property within our jurisdiction, and that's what the Dash 2 amendments were to do, to avoid having to form a whole new commission to do what many of us in the Capital Planning Commission already believe we can do.
Thank you. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may ask a question.
Sure.
My question has to do, who's on the commission now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, we are a statutory commission. By statute, we have three public members appointed by the governor. They used to be confirmed by the Senate. They are no longer confirmed by the Senate, but we've got three public members. One of those public members, by our own rule, is from the city of Salem, but no more than one of our public members is from the city of Salem. We have a public member from Portland and a public member from Eugene currently on there. We also have two members of our the Capital Planning Commission that are from the executive department. We have typically somebody from DOS and somebody from the executive department. We also have two members from the city of Salem, the mayor or the mayor's designee, the chair of the Salem Planning Commission or that chair's designee. We also have two ex officio members, one from appointed by the president of the Senate and one appointed by the Speaker of the House. Currently, that is Senator Durfler and Representative Mannix are serving in those ex officio positions.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
Why do you have a member from the city of Portland and a member from the city of Salem, I mean, and city of Eugene, when the only areas that you are responsible for are Marion and Polk County?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, again, that is by our rule. We didn't want the city of Salem to dominate the discussion of issues that pertain to the city of Salem. So there would not be strictly a city of Salem perspective. And that since state lands deal with even those in Marion and Polk have an impact on the rest of the state, we wanted to make sure that people outside of the Salem area as public members could participate and view the projects in the city of Salem as what's in the best interests of the whole state. It is only by coincidence that we have one from Portland and from Eugene, although we have tried to get as much diversity as possible. It's difficult to get members from east of the mountains to come over for our meetings, 2 or 3 hour meetings once a quarter.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
And what is your authority? You talk about these issues, but, I mean, is it safe to say that if somebody is making, if a public body is making a land use decision, they need your approval before they can move forward with their plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, by statute, yes, that is correct. We are another land use planning body. Our decisions are appealable to LUBA. I might say, as a matter of reality, that we have never had a decision appealed because our strength, if you will, as a planning body is to bring to the discussion all the interested parties and to try to work out a compromise. I have said before that the best thing, the most important thing that we bring to the table in these discussions is the table. And so we actually work on a consensus to make sure that the state agencies are aware of the city of Salem's needs, the city of Salem is aware of the state agency's needs, and because we have two legislative members, that the legislature is also considered in this, the needs and the wants of the legislature and the direction the legislature sees the state property in this area going.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
How will your duties change with the addition of disposition of land? And so what's the significance of that new responsibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, there are those among us on the Capital Planning Commission who are uncertain as to whether we have currently have authority or jurisdiction over. It's very clear that we have jurisdiction over the purchase of land because the term is mentioned in the statute. It is unclear because the word disposition is not in the statute or a similar phrase that we have jurisdiction over the sale of state property. I believe that we do because the sale of property has the same effect as a purchase of property on the neighborhoods, that there could be a negative or a positive impact on the local neighborhoods. But it is not clear. And rather than create a whole new commission to deal with an issue that is important to the city of Salem and to the surrounding communities, we thought that, or I should say Representative Mannix thought making sure that our jurisdiction was clear by adding the word disposition would make it clear to state agencies that before they sold property within our jurisdiction, they had to come to us and get our approval, and we could put it through our process and make sure that everybody understood what was going on and that there was approval by the surrounding neighborhoods as well as the city of Salem and Marion County officials.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
Along those lines, the state decides to dispose of a piece of property. At what point would they come to the Capital Planning Commission to receive your approval, and is your approval or disapproval requisite for the state to veto a state's decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I think it is conceivable that we would veto a sale. My hope is, and the way we have worked with all other projects, is that once the agencies know they have to come to us, eventually, they will come to us early on before they get too far down the line and see whether we would give approval to that kind of, or work with us in the process, our staff and with the city and the local neighborhoods, to make sure that, that their purchase of property, their building, or in this case, the disposition of property, is going to meet our approval. So we encourage the agencies to come to us early. We don't want to be the final decider of these, but we want to encourage the agencies and the local governments to work together throughout the process so that we don't have one, again, prodding on the other.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Do you have the legal authority to prevent the sale of state-owned land in Salem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I don't want to dodge the question. It is unclear by the statute whether we have that authority. We have had a couple of...
Under this bill.
Under this bill, I think, yes, under this bill, then we would have the authority and we would have the final say and could, in fact, void a sale of property if it did not fit the criteria, it was not acceptable to the surrounding communities, and so on and so forth. Now, I might say that we have, based on our makeup, we have three public members that essentially control the issue, because we have, again, two from the city of Salem, two from the state, and assuming that the state and the city of Salem are at odds, we're going to have three public members that are going to decide the vote. In my experience, we, with the exception of a couple of votes, we have never had anything but unanimous decisions. Again, because of the process that we go through, we're not a typical planning body where we try to decide one versus the other. We try to bring everybody into the middle through our good offices. But I guess it is, in answer to your question, I guess it is conceivable that we could say absolutely no.
Mr. Chair, along this line, I ask, because I get involved in real estate professionally and deal with public agencies, do you, when real estate decisions are being discussed, do you foresee the Capital Planning Commission being involved in the negotiations, or would you serve as a, would you be able to, do you have the ability to go into confidential session? I mean, my concern is that the Capital Planning Commission made up of some local officials, the state was selling prime land, such as Fairview, such as the State Fair, that members of the Capital Planning Commission might be privy to information which might influence the transaction favorably or not favorably.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, we have no interest and no authority over financial issues. We would not be a part of that discussion. However, we would be a part of a discussion as to a potential use for the property. And an example is right now there are two possible sales going on within our area, the sale of the Fairview area and the sale of the corrections property out near OSCI of that surplus property. We are involved in that discussion. The task force has been set up outside of the Capital Planning Commission, but it is we are sitting at that table. And that the eventual decisions will come through the Capital Planning Commission by agreement for our review. I anticipate that since we're a part of the ongoing task force looking at those, that we will not second guess what has gone on and what we've participated in. But we have no fiscal authority, and we would not participate in the discussions of price or anything else, but just potential use, to make sure, again, that an agency doesn't come in, and a prime example might be the blind school for the blind, where an agency, without consulting even the legislature, could conceivably go out and sell the property to a business or a developer that would be completely inappropriate. And since that property is currently outside of the zoning of the city of Salem, because it's state-owned property, something could be very detrimental to the city and to the surrounding communities.
All right. Any further questions? All right. I see none. Thank you. All right. We are...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2743.
All right. Representative Starr moves the dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2743. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm I'm inclined to not support this bill. I realize you need everybody here to vote for it tonight, but I'm happy to give you a courtesy vote if that's what it takes. But I have some problems with this bill. I'd like to talk to some other people about it before we. Ideally, I would like to hear more about from the state about any concerns they might have about giving the Capital Planning Commission carte blanche veto authority over any purchase or sale of state land. I'd like to hear from, I don't know, whichever state department would be involved with this before we sort of give this veto power to this commission.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate you taking the time to allow me to get better educated about what the commission does and what we hope it will do with this particular piece of legislation. But I also share my colleague from Southeast Portland's concern, Southwest, sorry. I move you around
Northwest.
Some. Northwest, yeah. Some part of Portland over
all
there. But I do share his concern because I'm not sure that we've had an opportunity to find out. I mean, does this mean that when the state hospital is sold, that, you know, that this commission has yay or nay approval about what happens to that property? Do they get to prevent the prison from going in Wilsonville, which is where it's going to end up going? I've got lots of questions about just what the role of this committee is, and I did understand thoroughly what the good representative from Salem wanted to do with the original bill, but this one kind of throws me for a loop because it looks like this is all public people, which is probably a good thing, but where is the public in that process? So I will be a no vote today. I may change that after I get more information, but today I won't be able to support this because I need more info.
Representative Starr, would you want to withdraw your motion?
If the chair wishes.
You could certainly do that. We could, we've got one more day we can work.
Certainly, I withdraw the motion.
All right. All right. The Representative Starr withdraws the motion. That concludes our business, and the committee is adjourned.
Final last day for now.